Okay, did everyone have a chance to sign three times? If you don't, I'll pass it again. Everybody did? Okay. Let's see, we're in verse 26. Yes? Oh, thanks for reminding me. Is there anyone here who doesn't... Oh, you know what? I forgot to bring them. They're down in my office. They moved me, and all my papers are in big boxes. But I think I know where it is. I found your papers. Remember we went to look for the papers? I got them, and I put them in my office. And I was supposed to bring them tonight, but I'm even more disorganized than usual because they moved me just today. Let's do it next week. Can you remind me again? I'll bring them next week, and we'll trade them next week. Yes. Yep. I was really worried that somebody stole them to destroy them. I have reason to believe that, but it wasn't true. So it wasn't just a wild idea. I have reason to believe that that could happen. Okay, so let's see now. All right, and after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off. Almost everybody puts it right at 62, but it's not true. It should be afterward. Be cut off, but not for himself. But not for himself. Now, the Hebrew is ambiguous and obscure here on the phrase, but not for himself. The Hebrew actually says, and have nothing. The Messiah shall be cut off and have nothing. And all the better, more modern translations say that. Rotherham, Darby, New American Standard Bible, American Standard Version, a Revised Standard Version, Amplified. They all carry that idea. Sometimes they say, and he shall have no one. He shall have no one, not nothing, but no one, no other person. Now, it either means nothing or no one. Some of them say, or there shall be none belonging to him. That would mean he didn't have any followers anymore. No one belonging to and defending him, Amplified says. But it means, and have nothing. Now, it's either going to mean he's cut off, but not for himself. That means he's cut off, that is, he dies for others. He didn't die for himself. His death is counted as a substitutionary atonement for others. Or else it means, and have nothing. Now, if it means that he doesn't have anything, then we have to explain what that would mean. The first interpretation is what the King James says. He dies, but not for himself. Now, that's obviously the whole gospel, that Christ would die, but he died for others. And the parallel passage again would be Isaiah 53:8, which says he's cut off out of the land of the living. But then the rest of the verse says, for the transgression of my people was he stricken. So cut off means cut off out of the land of the living, but not for himself. The rest of Isaiah 53:8 says, for the transgression of my people was he stricken. In other words, he wasn't cut off for himself, he was cut off for our transgressions. So Isaiah 53:8 would confirm this interpretation, he dies but not for himself. The other interpretation would be, and he has nothing. It means he didn't have any followers, he had no friends, he had no disciples, no supporters. When Christ died on the cross, he had nothing. He didn't have anyone cheering for him. He didn't have any supporters or followers or disciples or friends. He had no kingdom. He gave up everything. Christ had no believers, no kingdom, no money, no possessions. When Christ died on the cross, he had absolutely nothing. Crucifixion victims were often stripped naked. And so you see the picture of Jesus with a little cloth covering his loins. That's not historically accurate. historical accuracy says they wore nothing, absolutely, totally nothing. And so Christ had nothing. Now, as a human being, if you have no possessions, and Christ didn't, you know, he didn't own a home. Herbert W. Armstrong says he owned a palatial home on the waterfront in Bethsaida on the Sea of Galilee. You know, so anyway, ridiculous. He didn't have that. He didn't even have his clothes. He had nothing. He had no friends, no supporters, no backing, no money, nothing. Hanging on the cross, Jesus Christ had nothing. He didn't even have his own will. Well, he had it, but he gave it up. He gave up everything, even his will. As a man, all he has is his body, his soul, and his spirit. He'd already given his body in the sense that he just let them do anything to his body they wanted to do. And so they beat his body and they mistreated his body. He didn't even have his own will. That pertains to his soul, where he said, "Not my will, but thy will be done." So he gave up his will in the sense that he wouldn't do what he wanted, he would do what God wanted. So his body was given, his soul was given, as evidenced by the giving of his will, and then, who knows what he said on the cross? He said, "Into thy hands I commend my spirit." And so he gave his spirit. In other words, if you're hanging on the cross and you have absolutely nothing, the only thing left that you could possibly give to anybody or for anybody is your life. You have your human life. You possess that. You don't possess anything else. Christ even gave that. Really, all anybody could ask for you maybe is to take your blood. You have blood. You know, you've got that. You don't have much else. And so, he even gave that. He gave absolutely everything that he was and absolutely everything he had to God. He gave his body, he gave his soul, and as he died, he gave his spirit to God. He was totally given to God as a man. He had nothing. I'm sure that's what it means. He didn't even have his own righteousness, which he had earned by obedience without sin. It was demonstrated. Because on the sin he became sin on the cross, and therefore he was even without his own righteousness. So he gave up that. When he had given everything and was nailed to the cross, all he had left to give was his soul, which is his very life itself, and he had absolutely nothing left. Once you give up your life, you have nothing else you can give. That's giving your all, and that's what Jesus did. And so I like this interpretation, and have nothing, because it shows the completeness of the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. I'm not sure which one God meant, whether he meant he died for us or he died having nothing. We can explain either one of the interpretations, though. Okay, so after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. If he's cut off after 62, that would mean he's cut off after 69. It would mean he's cut off in or during the 70th week. It would mean those two things. Cut off after 62 means cut off after 69, and it means cut off in or during the 70th week. And then it says, "And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary." This prince is Titus, the Roman general, who destroyed the city of Jerusalem in AD 70. His father, Vespasian, was the Roman emperor. Vespasian is spelled V-E-S-P-A-S-I-A-N. That's his dad. And Titus is the prince. He's the son of the father, who is the king or the emperor. And so he's a prince, which is what the scripture says, the prince. He's second in command, and he inherited the Roman emperorship when his father died. And so it fits Titus to call him a prince. Now, the word prince here actually means one occupying the front. That's the literal meaning of the word prince in Hebrew, although I'm not trying to point out this is some unusual word. It isn't. It's the regular word for prince. But it carries the idea of being at the front. And I thought it was interesting that Josephus pointed out that when they marched into the city of Jerusalem for the battle, or into the area of Jerusalem, Titus was right in front. He's right in the front as a prince. He said there was a few auxiliaries and baggage and soldiers to protect these. And then Titus was right there in the front, followed by the rest of the army. Pikemen, horsemen, engines, tribunes, leaders, ensigns, the main army, servants, baggage, and mercenaries. So he's right up there at the head. And the people of the prince would refer to Titus' Roman armies. Notice that it says the people destroy the city and the sanctuary. Notice that it does not say the prince destroyed the city and the sanctuary. It says the people of the prince. In other words, his armies did it, not him. And this is an amazing story. Josephus tells the story of the destruction of Jerusalem. It's found in Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 4, Section 1 through 8. Book 6, Chapter 4, Sections 1 to 8. The story goes like this. Titus wanted to save the Jewish temple. And so he told his army men, do not destroy the temple, merely kill the people. And so he used ladders and battering rams to enter the city rather than burning it down to the ground. The Jews, however, made a great slaughter against the Roman army. And Titus, perceiving he would lose too many men, decided to burn the temple gates and thereby gain entrance. And so he gave orders to burn the temple to the ground. After several days, they were unable to burn the total temple. They could only get fires going in little portions at a time. And so Titus thought it was wasting too much time to burn it, so he gave orders again, do not burn the temple. He said they should not revenge an inanimate holy house, but the men themselves. And he was not in any case for burning down so vast a work which would ornament Rome for having conquered it. And so he ordered his troops now to actually take water and extinguish the fires. And so his troops now had to go back to fires they had started and throw water on them and try to stop it. The Jews attacked the troops who were fighting the fires because they didn't believe these Romans really wanted to do that. In other words, they're saying, oh yeah, you're here to stop the fire, sure, you know. And so they were shooting arrows and dumping rocks down on the Romans who didn't particularly want to put the fire out anyway. But they were acting under orders. And so this enraged the Roman soldiers, that these Jews would fight them, Romans, as they were trying to do something for the Jews, which is save their temple. And so one soldier, in a fit of rage, asked to be lifted upon the shoulders of another soldier. And he did. And with a two-man stack, he reached with a torch to a high golden window of the temple and set it on fire, from which the flames fell down into the interior of the temple and started it blazing. These flames eventually engulfed the entire temple. Titus was reclining in his tent outside the city, and he was informed by a runner that the sanctuary of the temple was now ablaze, contrary to his orders. So he and Caesar Vespasian, who happened to be there, ran into the temple and made attempts through verbal commands and hand signals to extinguish the blaze. When they ran to the Holy of Holies, they were so amazed by its beauty, they thought it imperative to save it. But the soldiers were moved more by their passion and hatred for the Jews than their allegiance to Caesar, and spurred by the hope of plunder of much gold, they ran through the chambers spreading the flames. Josephus says one Roman soldier even ran to Vespasian himself and restrained him by holding his arms down at his sides physically so he could not give arm signals to the other soldiers telling them to put out the fire. And so the Roman soldiers ran from court to court to court, spreading the flames and throwing the fire around the temple. And from this, the entire Jewish temple was burned to the ground. Now, the conclusion here is the people of the prince destroyed the sanctuary. Because you'll remember, Titus was trying to stop it, and it was the soldiers who did it. What an amazing prophecy that God would say, the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. God knew this would happen. And so he didn't say the prince did it. He said the people did it. And that's exactly what happened. Now it says, destroy the city and the sanctuary. So what about the city? Well, again, this is told in Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 7, Chapter 1, Sections 1 to 3. I'll quote a little bit. He says, now as soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, because there remained none to be the objects of their fury, Caesar gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as were of the greatest eminency, in order to demonstrate to posterity what kind of city it was, and how well fortified, which the Roman valor had subdued. But for all the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation, that there was left nothing to make those that came there believe it had ever been inhabited. What an amazing destruction. They laid it even with the ground, except they left a few gigantic towers so you could see what a great thing it was they conquered. This was the end that Jerusalem came to by the madness of those that were for innovations, a city otherwise of great magnificence and of mighty fame among all mankind. And so the conclusion is both the city probably refers to the people and the buildings of the city, and they were destroyed by Titus' army. The end of the city and the sanctuary came when Titus' Roman army flooded into Jerusalem, killed the people, burned the temple, and knocked the walls down to their very foundation. I believe another prophecy that was fulfilled was Matthew 27:25. I suppose it's not really a statement, prophecy as much as it is just a statement. Matthew 27:25. This is at Pilate's hall. You know, if you've ever seen a Bible movie where they showed this crowd of the Jews, you know, where Jesus and Barabbas were there. You ever seen one of those movies where they have this huge crowd of Jews and they say, crucify him, crucify him, you know, and Pilate comes out on this walkway and he says, do you will that I release unto you Jesus or release unto you Barabbas? And they wanted them to release Barabbas and set him free and then kill Jesus. Well, at that story, the Bible says in Matthew 27, when Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it. So he turned him over to the Jews. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Boy, what a dangerous statement. What they're saying is, you go ahead and shed his blood, and his blood be upon us. In other words, we're willing to take the responsibility for the shedding of blood of Jesus. So you know what I think happened? I think God took him up on that. And when they said, his blood be upon us, that was fulfilled 40 years later at AD 70. When the Roman armies entered the city of Jerusalem, it was at a feast time of year. There were 500,000 Jews who lived in Jerusalem. The estimate is 1,300,000 Jews were slain in this war, which means it was at a time when the population was more than double what it normally was. It was packed with Jews who had come from all over the world for the feast, you know, the Passover feast. And so there they are. And what happened is the army came in, they surrounded the city. They waited 2 days, and they let anybody flee who wanted to flee, and the Christians fled. Some of you have probably heard that little story before. Jesus said in Matthew 24, when ye see Jerusalem surrounded, flee. I'll read you that scripture. It says, oh, excuse me, it's in Luke. I don't have my own Bible. I left my Bible at home. Yeah, he said, Luke 21:20, and when ye see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it, that is, in the middle of Jerusalem, depart out. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Now, I believe this prophecy goes beyond the AD 70 destruction of Jerusalem. Because when he said, when ye see Jerusalem compassed with armies, plural, that wasn't true in AD 70. It was only one army, Roman army. The Roman army under Titus. The armies that he refers to ultimately refer to the Armageddon armies. And that prophecy will be fulfilled again at that time. But there's a type here that was fulfilled partially in these times. And so when they said, let his blood be upon us, their blood was shed. You've probably heard pastors say this. It's true. Josephus wrote it in his biography, his history. And he said that the blood ran so thick that it put out fires in the city. And it seems incredible that blood could run like a river in the street. But they say that is what happened. And fires from buildings actually were extinguished by a flow of blood down the street, which is gross, but that's what he said happened. Okay, so the people of the prince destroyed the city. I say that means the people. City is the people, and the buildings both happened. 1,300,000 Jews. Plus, many were captured and sold into slavery, like 100,000 of them or something. And then the buildings were destroyed, laid flat to the ground so that you wouldn't know Jerusalem had ever been inhabited. And then, of course, the sanctuary was burned to the ground, and I read you that story. Okay, back to Daniel. So he says, the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. The word flood here is an allegorical flood. It doesn't mean a literal flood of water, because it's an obvious figure of speech. Jerusalem is built on the top of a big hill. It is impossible to flood Jerusalem with water. There's not enough water around to flood it. And that's never happened in history. I don't think it ever will happen. So this flood is an allegorical flood. It means a flood of armies. It means a flood of armies. A flood is like when water comes in and just overflows the city. Well, that's what the armies did. They came pouring in through the gates like a big flood of water came up to the gate that had holes in it. And like the water would come pouring in and flood the city, so the army men came pouring in and flooded the city. It's an allegorical way of saying it. A synonym for a flood is an inundation. You ever heard that? An inundation? Well, this is an inundation of warriors. You get the picture here of one of these Bible kind of movies again that some of us have seen, where you see breaches or holes in the wall, and then you see horses leaping up and going in, and army men running in, 10 and 20 at a time, and they're riding in on camels and on horses, and they're running, and you have soldiers and warriors and weapons and horses and spears, and things are flying in, and the armies are running in, and people are giving orders, and they got all their armor on, and they're just pouring in, wave after wave after wave after wave, nonstop, pouring into the city. It's like a flood. If you could watch it, you'd see this barrier here, and then this breaks down, and they pour in here, and this breaks down, and they pour in here, and this breaks down, and they pour in here. They're pouring in like water, just filling the entire city, and just killing Jews indiscriminately. That's what happened. That's why Christ said, flee. Historians tell us that when they surrounded the city, they gave 2 days and they let anybody go who wanted to go. And so the Christians, remembering the words of Jesus, when you see Jerusalem surrounded, flee, they fled because they obeyed their Lord. And the Jews didn't. They were slain. A parallel passage would be Nahum 1:8. Nahum 1:8 is a prophecy in the Old Testament that uses the same euphemism, flood, for a flood of armies. Now, this is describing the destruction of Nineveh, which is the capital of Assyria, and it says, but with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place. And it's talking about Nineveh, and Nineveh is here in the middle of this big plain. Okay? So there's Nineveh. It's on the river, but, you know, this thing's way up in the mountains. It's, you're not going to flood out Nineveh. No way. And so it's talking about a flood of armies again. It's the same figure of speech. So the flood here refers to a flood of army men. It was Titus' army who destroyed the city and the sanctuary, and they were destroyed during the AD 70 siege against Jerusalem by a flood of army men pouring into the city. And then it says, under the end of the war, desolations are determined. And the word determined means decided upon. Under the end of the war, desolations are determined or decided upon. And so it means, until the war in AD 70 was over, desolations were determined by God. Desolations were determined by God. Now notice it says desolations, plural. Desolations, plural, are determined by God. And I think it's because it has to do more than just breaking down the buildings. Desolations refers to several kinds of destruction, not just one kind of destruction. They were determined or decided upon by God as a fit punishment of the Jews. I would say there's physical desolations in the sense that their city was actually burned and leveled. There's spiritual desolations in the sense that the people were destroyed spiritually from God by their sins. And then thirdly, I would say socially or politically, there was desolations in the sense that the Jewish fabric of society was destroyed in AD 70. They basically no longer had a homeland, although some of them stuck around and they really weren't kicked out of Palestine until AD 135. From AD 135, there's basically no Jews in Palestine until 1948. The Romans came in. Jerusalem was rebuilt. The Romans came in. They allowed them there. But in 135, they kicked them all out. And from that time till modern times, Jews did not live there. And so it extends beyond physical desolation of the city to include spiritual and political and social desolation of this people who crucified Christ. So under the end of the war, desolations are determined means God decided that the Jews and their homeland were to be made desolate. And he's not going to give up until this war is over in AD 70. Okay, are there any questions now on verse 26. Make sure that I covered everything I want to cover. Okay.
What did the Jews do to motivate the cemetery Romans to destroy
them? Oh, well, they had done many things over a process of time from 64 BC on, when Pompey, the Roman general, conquered Palestine and put them under Roman domination. For example, the Romans imposed taxes and the Jews often didn't pay, or they paid reluctantly. So there was tax evasion. There's a lot. We could make a long list of things the Jews did. Tax evasion. There was political rebellion. There was actual fighting by the Jewish zealots By the way, that's the correct way to pronounce that word, is zealots. It's like saying zealous, and so you call them zealots. They're really not zealots, even though they're called that sometimes. They're zealots, Jewish zealots. And so, among other things, there's those things. Those zealots, boy, they were like assassins. They're little groups of Jewish assassins, and they made raids on Roman outposts all the time. They were always killing Roman soldiers in Jerusalem over and over and over and over again. And for the last 4 years, prior to AD 70, there were literal civil wars in Jerusalem with Jews having raids upon the Roman army until they finally built a little citadel in the middle of the city of Jerusalem. It was like an army barracks, but it was a tall tower, and the Romans built it intentionally taller than the temple. And so they would sit up there on top, way up there, and they would look down, watching the Jews in their temple, these Roman army men. And the Jews hated it, because here's these guys looking down, watching us in our temple, see? And they have these army men up there in that citadel. And that was a big sore point. And the Jews hated that. They'd kill Romans at night, Roman soldiers. So there was a lot of stuff like that. They were always rebelling. In our class, Perspectives of the Gospels, Mark tells some of those stories. Did you ever take that class? He told the story of when they went to put the Roman eagle in the temple. Do you remember that? They went to put a Roman eagle in the temple of Jerusalem. And the governor of Palestine ordered this eagle to be put right inside the temple. Now, the Bible says in Exodus 20, verse 4, not to make any graven image of anything that is in the earth beneath or the sky above, etc. It's the commandment against idolatry. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image of any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. And so they said, we will not have that Roman eagle in our temple. That is idolatry. And so they refused to allow the Roman army to put that thing in. So the governor called a meeting of the Jews in the city of Jerusalem, and he got them all into a big arena, and they met, and he said, now that you're all here, I'm going to enforce my decree. And you'll notice there are Roman soldiers surrounding this arena. And the eagle is going in, and that's final. And they said, slit our throats first. We will not allow it at all. And they would have let him. But see, the governor backed down because he was put there to rule over the Jews, not massacre them. And so he knew if he just had a wholesale massacre of over 100,000 Jews, his head would probably roll too by Caesar. Because his job wasn't to kill everybody under his dominion, it was just keep them in line. And so he did. He backed down. And he let them all go, and they didn't put the Roman eagle in. But see, that irked him. And there's a lot of stories like that about things that happened. And it ended up in a big war. So that's the natural cause. Now, the spiritual cause is that God was getting blood for blood for the death of Christ. That's what I believe. In fact, I believe that a lot of these pogroms all through history against Jews are just God's judgment on them for killing the Messiah. Jimmy Swaggart has said that and been criticized roundly in the press because he attributed the Holocaust of Hitler to the judgment of God against the Jews. And people said that's racism and so forth, but I don't know. It seems like it to me. It seems like God has a lot of judgment that he's poured out upon the Jews all through history. He even said way back in the book of Deuteronomy, if you don't walk with God, I'll allow this to happen and this to happen and this to happen and this to happen. And a lot of it is that kind of stuff. I'll chase you from nation to nation. You'll shake at the shaking of a leaf, he said, which shows the inward fear. Jews live that way. They really do. They have been persecuted so much that they live in fear that it could happen again. So you hear this little slogan among Jews, something like, "May it never happen again." What is that slogan, David? Do you know what it is? There's a little slogan they have, like, the slogan is, "Never again." If you ever see a bumper sticker and it says, "Never again," that's a Jew. And what they mean is, the slaughter under Hitler, may it never happen again. It's referring to the Holocaust. Okay, any other questions on verse 26? Okay, verse 27. "And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week." Now we are to the heart of the prophecy. Who is the he in the verse? I say the he who confirms the covenant is Christ. And I say that the word confirm means to assure the certainty of. It means to assure the certainty of an existing covenant. To assure the certainty of an existing covenant. Now notice that it says, "He shall confirm the covenant with many." Many. It doesn't say all, it says many. Many means many of the 12 tribes of national Israel. It means many individuals of the 12 tribes of national Israel. Now, I believe that this confirmation occurred for 3.5 years during Christ's ministry, and then it will also occur again for 3.5 years at the end of time. And there's a debate as to exactly when the second half of it is. But remember, when Christ ministered to the Jews in the first century, he basically is ministering to the 3-tribe southern nation, Judah. He's not ministering to the 10 tribes because they're not there. But the 3 tribes had smatterings of all 12 in them. And so God says when he confirms the covenant, he's going to confirm it with many. He can't really say he's going to confirm it with all because all were not there at the first century when he ministered. Moreover, at the end time, I don't believe all the Jews come back right at the beginning of the millennium. You have the second coming of Jesus, and it takes a long time to get all the Israelites back in the millennium. We'll see this when we study the millennium. They're coming back for a long period of time. And so when Christ confirms the covenant, whether it's the first 3.5 years before the second coming or the first 3.5 years after the second coming, regardless, he's not doing it to all the Jews. He's only doing it to some of them. You got some of them here in his ministry, basically 3 tribes. And if he does it here, he does it to the 144,000, and they're Israelites. But it's not all Israelites in the world, it's just some. It's many, like he said. Or else it's only the Jews who are there at the first 3.5 years after the second coming, which is not all the 10 tribes. It's only part of them. There's a lot more Israelites in the world who he doesn't confirm the covenant with because they're not there. So it says he confirms the covenant with many, meaning many individuals from all the tribes. And then it says he confirms the covenant with many for 1 week. That's 7 years. And the 2 segments would be during his ministry for 3.5 years, and then at the end time for 3.5 years. And it's either going to be the first or the last 3.5 years before the second coming or the first 3.5 years after the second coming. It's got to be one of those two. So the covenant is confirmed for 7 years. After it's confirmed, then it's carried out or fulfilled. Notice there's a difference between confirming and fulfilling. It doesn't say he will fulfill the covenant. He won't fulfill the covenant. He's going to confirm the covenant. He's going to assure the certainty of the covenant. And then once the covenant is assured, then it actually happens and is a force and fulfilled during the 1,000-year millennium. So I say it's confirmed first and fulfilled later. And I make a distinction between those 2 things. So once it is confirmed by Christ, In other words, the certainty is assured, then it actually starts and becomes in force, and the millennium begins, and Christ reigns for 1,000 years. Okay, now let's go back and talk about this theory that the he refers to the Antichrist. And that is a wrong theory, and I want to give you some arguments against it right now.
So let me erase this material and we'll start over again. These are arguments against the idea that the he is the Antichrist. See if I can get through this in the last few minutes here. Okay, number one.
The pronoun he must refer to the subject of verse 26. Which is the Messiah. You follow that? It says, he shall confirm the covenant. The he has to have an antecedent. So the he is the antecedent to he would be the subject of verse 26. And that's the Messiah. And so that argument would say, the antecedent is Messiah. Number two, the pronoun he must agree in person, number, and gender with its antecedent. The antecedent is the noun in the prior context that the pronoun stands for. And its antecedent can't be the object of a modifying clause. Therefore, prince is not the antecedent. Now, let me see if I can explain this. There's a grammatical rule which says that a pronoun cannot have as its antecedent the object of a modifying clause. A pronoun cannot have as its antecedent the object of a modifying clause. This is a simple grammar rule. Now, watch this. I'll give you an example of what I mean. For example, the mother, and I'm going to put in parentheses, of your sister that shall come, borrowed my dictionary yesterday, that's verse 26, and verse 27 says, and she gave it back to me. Now, this is constructed identically to the problem we have, where you have, and he shall confirm the covenant. He shall do an action. The he has as its antecedent the subject of verse 26, and it cannot be the object of a modifying clause. See this clause here? That's what you call a modifying clause because it modifies mother. It says the mother. Now we're going to modify mother. What mother? Well, this mother. The mother with blue shoes. The mother that is tall. The mother of the sister that shall come. The mother that says, the mother that always says so and so and so and so. It's a certain kind of a mother. And it modifies what kind of a mother it is. Now the object of the modifying clause is sister. You know if I said this sentence to you, the mother of your sister that shall come borrowed my dictionary yesterday and she gave it back to me. Who's the she? Is it the sister or the mother? You automatically say mother. You never say sister. Because you always know The subject is mother. The mother did this, and she. That's what you're really saying. This is parenthetical. So that's what they're saying. They're saying, the Messiah so-and-so and the people of the prince that shall come shall do this, and he. You never go back to prince. That prince is the object of a modifying clause. So the pronoun he has to agree in person, number, and gender with its antecedent. All you really have is this. Verse 26 says Messiah. Verse 26 says the people of the prince. And then verse 26 says the prince. You've only got three choices to make, right? It has to be Messiah, people of the prince, or prince. It can't be the people of the prince because that's plural. You have to agree in numbers. So it has to be Messiah or prince. Messiah and prince are both legitimate choices because they're both in the same person and they're both masculine. And so they agree in person and they agree in gender and they agree in number because they're both singular. So these are both valid choices. But we rule out prince because it's the object of a modifying clause. And this grammar rule says that prince cannot be the antecedent.
You follow that argument? It's a good argument. It's a grammatical argument and it makes sense. Okay.
Another argument is, argument number three, the pronoun he must refer to someone in the prophecy. And the Antichrist is not mentioned in the prophecy. Now, those who say the Antichrist is the correct meaning say that the Antichrist is mentioned in the prophecy. They say the verse that says, the prince that shall come, that prince is the Antichrist. And so they would deny our third argument. But we say the Antichrist is not mentioned, and so that is still a valid point. It's just a disagreement on interpretation. Was that our last spell, or do we have 5 minutes? Okay, well, we'll have to stop there. Okay, next week, it'll only take me one more hour to finish lecturing on the 70 weeks of Daniel. So what we'll do is, I'll finish, and then we'll have the test the following week. Okay? The week after that is camp meeting break? Okay, if it is, then we'll have the test the next week after that. Okay, I'll finish next week. We do have class next week, right? Okay. Sorry, I was kind of disoriented tonight.